Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hello, listeners. This is Rebecca Monk from Ealing in London. And I'm delighted to say that you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Thank you very much to Rebecca Monk from Ealing for your lovely intro there. Ealing not far from my neck of the woods and Ealing Broadway on the Twyford Paddington line, which my dad used to commute to work on. So thank you, Rebecca, and welcome to our Day 7 Australian Open podcast. It's been a day of two sessions, I think, today. We've had the day session, which was sort of upsets galore, really. No sort of seismic, headline-grabbing, enormous upset, but quite a lot of, you know, low-key big upsets. And then we've had the evening session, which is, well, actually, full disclosure, it hasn't quite ended yet. It's 10 past 11 in the evening Melbourne time, which makes it 10 past midday Solihull time. And Matteo Berrettini and Pablo Carreño Busta are still on court, but Berrettini has a two sets to love lead, but it's nip and tuck all the way. He could easily, you know, take the scenic route here. So we'll keep you updated so you get that out-of-date tennis news. But assuming that Berrettini does come through that, the evening session has gone according to script, if not been slightly disappointing. And I'm referring to Barty against Ines Anisimova when I say that. And we will come on to talk about that in a little while. But I think we should talk about the day session first, because I wasn't really expecting any of what ended up happening in the day session today. Really, a lot of it took me massively by surprise. I think the only result that didn't surprise me was Krejcikova beating Azarenka, but the scoreline of that still massively surprised me, how one-sided it was for Krejcikova. Was it one of those days, Matt, when the upsets ended up being infectious? What was going on at Melbourne Park today?
It was a bit weird, actually, wasn't it? And I must say, those first two matches on the Rod Laver Arena, Paula Badosa versus Madison Keys and Barbora Krejcikova versus Victoria Azarenka, straight up were pretty disappointing as contests. I had really high hopes for them. I probably thought both would go three sets. If we take them one at a time, I thought Keys Badosa was out first. And when you get a scoreline like that, I think it was 6-3, 6-1 to Madison Keys, there has to be two things going on. And absolutely, Madison Keys was awesome. You know, really, really brilliant. Just carried on the way she's been playing all year, really. Teeing off on her shots. Her game looked sort of perfectly calibrated. It was powerful but contained. She had 25 winners come the end of the match. She hit seven clean winners on return in the first set off Badosa's serve. Just really dominated on that shot, and I think put a lot of pressure on Badosa, who racked up the double faults as the match went on. She was excellent, and it was fun to watch Madison Keys be like that. But at the same time, Badosa was way off. You know, she hit the wall, I think, frankly, today. She didn't have it in her leg. She didn't have it in her serve. And yes, she did quite well to make the start of the second set competitive. But as soon as she went down another break, it was all over. And it was a disappointing contest, really.
Yeah, it was quite jarring to see her struggle physically that much, I think. Maybe in the fullness of time we'll find out that there was something going on that we don't currently know about. But on current information, she was just kind of kind of spent out there from all the tennis of winning the Sydney title, and in particular that three-setter against Marta Kostyuk a couple of days ago, played in the blazing heat of the day. You know, she referenced that. I was very surprised. I asked her about the heat that she was playing in once again today, and I was expecting her to sort of look at me funny and say, you know, I'm a Spaniard, I'm fine with the heat, thanks. And I'm, you know, she's clearly an incredible athlete and physical specimen, and she actually said, yeah, she did struggle in the heat today. And I was really surprised by that. You know, she looked exhausted. She looked gone in the post-match press conference. And with the benefit of hindsight, she looked the same after the Kostyuk match 2 days ago. I just thought that 2 days would be enough for her to recover. But yeah, she said the heat got to her, and you know, at that point I'm thinking, goodness me, is she perhaps not quite as fit as I thought she was? But then Maria Sakkari, who definitely is fit, came in after her defeat to Jessica Pegula, which we'll talk about in a little while. And she also said she struggled in the heat today. So I think if Maria Sakkari is saying it's a challenge, then probably it could get to anyone. But it didn't get to Madison Keys, who's just loving life and a really uplifting story. We've sort of had smatterings of quotes coming out from her, you know, after she won the Adelaide title last week, about her new perspective on the sport and where that's come from. And, you know, she elaborated on that a bit today. I had the chance to ask her a few questions in the press conference. And, you know, she said she had previously been feeling like the internal pressure she was placing on herself felt like a literal weight on her chest and a dark cloud hanging around her. She said she was suffering from anxiety, not sleeping, and she said she was not fun to be around. And she referenced, you know, a stern talking to that somebody gave her that kind of, you know, shook her around and made her think, I've got to start doing something different here. And, you know, she says the difference is I found a way to just enjoy tennis and love tennis. And you love to hear that, David.
Yeah, you do. And I do feel for her in that way. And it's not that dissimilar to what we've heard from Naomi Osaka, isn't it, earlier this week, about trying to override that system and not get into the whole, I'm supposed to be this and I'm supposed to be ranked this and I'm supposed to win this and all the rest of it. And Madison Keys has had that since she came along as a teenager. I remember commentating on her when she was 18 years of age in the Eastbourne final, alongside Martina Navratilova, who was just glowing with how exciting a player she was. And she beat Angelique Kerber that day. And everybody was predicting this woman is going to be world number one. And I was
we had Brad Gilbert doing that on this podcast, didn't we?
Yeah.
Not long before he blocked you on Twitter, David.
Yes, he's unblocked me since. Hi, Brad. But yes, I did go through about a three-year sort of, you know, freeze in the freezer, frozen out. But anyway, yeah, I mean, Keys had all that pressure on her shoulders, and I think it got to her, and I think it must get to a lot of these players, and I'm sad about that because, well, you know, she probably doesn't even know who I am, but we are part of the media and we're part of that conversation, that narrative that happens. And look, it's the way it is. We're going to talk about the sport, but I do feel sad when a player struggles in that situation. But equally, I'm thrilled for her if she's managed to just shed those shackles now and play, because she's a hell of a player. And, you know, quite an experienced player, 26 years of age now. You referenced the Major Keys line, Matt, a couple of days ago about how she has shown up at the big Grand Slam tournaments. It's just she hasn't won any of them. And it still feels as though even now we have yet to see her very best tennis at a Grand Slam properly strung together. Now, we might be seeing it right here. It's a bit like Gael Monfils. I think Gael Monfils is playing the best tennis of his career right now. Maybe Keys is. And that's really exciting to think, because tools-wise, her game has not been overtaken. She hits the ball as hard as anybody.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was drawing gasps, wasn't it, from the crowd, particularly on the forehand wing today. It is still gasp-inducing power from Madison Keys. And she was asked about that, actually, you know, how conscious she is of the power that she produces and the effect that it has on people watching. And the answer was, you know, not very aware of it. She said it's so natural to her and so normal that, you know, she actually said that's probably why I overhit sometimes, because, you know, I'm calibrated for that to be standard. And she talked about how her grandfather, I think it was, she said, really was into baseball. And when she was starting to play tennis as a kid, she was trying to hit home runs rather than hit winners. And she kind of said, I think for better or for worse, that explains my game. Wow. And it was a lovely little self-aware moment. Yeah, it really was.
And it's power that takes other players back, because Barossa had never played her before. And she said that she thought she was serving really slowly, Barossa, because of how easily and how quickly Keys was returning the serve. And then she would look at the shot clock and realise, no, my serving pace was perfectly good. It was up at its usual 180 kilometres per hour or whatever it is. It's just that Keys has a ball strike that Barossa hadn't really witnessed before or felt before, wow. I think. And it took her back. And I think on the ground strokes, Barossa's ball was sitting right in the Keys strike zone, I must say. Keys was able to get on top of it and just really dominate the rallies. Yeah, she was awesome.
She plays Barbora Krejcikova now, who she described in her press conference as someone that makes tennis look easy. Krejcikova beat Victoria Azarenka today 6-2, 6-2. And it was just never close. It just wasn't the match that any of us wanted it to be. Krejcikova just looked like she had so much time on the ball throughout the match, which is sort of the magic trick that she's constantly performing, isn't it? And Azarenka was receiving treatment throughout the second set for an issue with her neck. Looked like she's had what I've had for the past few days, which is just sort of sleeping a bit funny and getting a crick in your neck, which sounds, you know, so a bit like blisters, really. So pedestrian and so temporary, and yet kind of so crippling at the same time.
Try playing Barbora Krejcikova with a crick in your neck, and you're not going to get very far.
Mm. I saw Goran Ivanisevic win a semi-final, I think it was in Miami one year, in the mid-90s. And he was he played brilliantly all the way through. You know, he'd been knocking out big names, gets through, plays Agassi in the final, and he sleeps a bit funny. And he comes out onto the court the next day, and he played two games, and he had to retire. Couldn't serve. He couldn't even roll his arm over properly. And they had to call Jim Courier down from Dade County to come and play an exhibition with Agassi on the spot in order to just give the crowd something to watch.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of game over for doing anything normal. I couldn't look over at Matt normally a couple of days ago because of the crick in my neck. I was having to do a sort of weird robotic turning my whole body in order to speak to him. Krejcikova through to the quarterfinal. She kept saying in the on-court post-match interview, after that, when I just can't believe it. So I asked her in her press conference, you know, about that disbelief. You know, I said, you know, when do you think that'll end? And she said, oh, I wouldn't describe it as disbelief. And I felt like chipping back, you literally did describe it that way. But I didn't.
I'm actually surprised you didn't.
she was really thoughtful about it, actually. She said, you know, she spent a lot of time trying to think of the exact word to describe it. And at first she came up with surprised, and she said, oh, it's not quite surprised. She said, oh, I can't think of the word in English. But she said something has changed for her in the off season in terms of how she appreciates her success. She said the off season was the first opportunity she got to process her new success and her new status in the game. And as much as on the court today in the moment of victory, she was saying, I can't believe it. I think she can believe it. I think what she was saying in press, you know, with the benefit of a bit of time and consideration, was I actually can believe it now. I accept my new status in the game, and there's no imposter syndrome there. She knows she's earned it and deserves to be there. I think what she's trying to get across with the disbelief is that she'll never take it for granted.
Yeah, that's how it sounds from what you describe, and that she's just chuffed to bits about it because she's been somewhere else in her career where she had all this in doubles, but she never really assumed that this would just happen for her in singles, and then it did. And I can understand what you mean. I mean, you win the French Open, you're straight off to Wimbledon, and you do all of those things. And then you're off in the summer to, you've got the Olympics, and you've got the US Open, and she played the Billie Jean King Cup final, and she plays the WTA finals. There is not a moment to really process what's happened to you. And when it is such a massive shift the way it is for her, then I really get that. And I actually think her loving the life, her loving the achievement, and not just assuming this is what happens, because that wasn't built into her and programmed into her from a young age necessarily, is one of the most endearing elements about watching her and enjoying her career, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. And Krejcikova Keys is definitely one to tune in for. I think that'll be a cracker in a couple of days' time. The other quarterfinal that we've set up today from this top half of the draw will be Jessica Pegula against Ash Barty. Now, I suppose Pegula beating Sakkari isn't a massive upset. Sakkari would have been the favourite on paper, but we know how close their meeting was in Miami last year, Sakkari saving 6 points to come through in the end. Pegula beat Sakkari 7-6, 6-3 today. And while that first set obviously was close going to the tiebreak, Pegula won that tiebreak 7-0. It's pretty rare that you see that. Sometimes you see, you know, a 6-0 lead, but it's very rare that there's a clean sweep and a tiebreak, and she played a terrible tiebreak, Maria Sakkari, didn't she, Matt? And she never really recovered from that.
No, she didn't. It was an error-strewn tiebreak. And I think what was interesting is something Pegula said in her press conference, that, okay, she lost to Sakkari in Miami, but she got so close to winning, she knew she could win. You know, it's not like she was blown off the court by Sakkari. She knew that her game hurt Sakkari that day. And what I really like about Jessica Pegula is she understands her game and the limits of it, I think, perfectly now at this stage in her career. She knows what she's good at, and she knows what she's not so good at. And she knew today that taking on Sakkari in a grind fest, she was not going to win that match. She had to be the one getting the first strike in. She had to be the one hitting the strong returns. And she did. She played the sort of match on her terms, I felt like. And she's so even-tempered on court. She's so measured that I think it makes her a great front runner. She doesn't allow doubt to creep in as she nears the finish line. She just sort of stays on her track. And as soon as she took the ascendancy in that second set, never really felt like Sakkari was actually going to come back. I think Pegula was kind of in control throughout, and she was the better player. She deserved to win.
That second set was strange from Sakkari, and there was a reference in press from Pegula that she kind of knew, not that she had to get it done in two sets, but it was a whole different match if it went to three sets because of Sakkari's physicality and her ability to not fade and wilt in challenging conditions. But as I said, Sakkari struggled in those conditions, and she's, you know, I asked her about the heat, and she said, yeah, I did really feel it today. And she sort of mused a bit, and she said, it might have been the stress that made me feel it today. And
right.
The stress is what concerns me about Sakkari. Mm. you know, in her first round match, she won in straight sets in the end, but it was almost making me anxious to watch how tight she looked. And I know she's got that very tight, you know, muscular. It's not a loose game, is it? It's a very muscular game. So it's always going to look a bit tighter and a bit, I keep saying tight. I'm looking for vocabulary
but I
here.
Understand but, what you mean.
But I just feel there's a tension and a stress in her that can overcome her.
There are different types of fitness. I mean, she's clearly supremely fit. And when you look at her as well, it's breathtaking to see how chiseled she is and all the rest of it. But I think there's something in that, both in terms of the stress. I think you can end up gripping the racket too tightly because she wants it so much, and that can tire you out. The heat, obviously. But also, you know, sprinters are built incredibly as muscular individuals, aren't they? But the marathon runners are skinny and lithe, and they don't carry much muscle. I mean, there used to be the boxer, Frank Bruno, who was the most well-conditioned athlete imaginable to look at him, and yet he would run out of steam as fights would go on because he was heavy and he was muscular. Now, I don't necessarily think that that's the case with Zachary. I've seen her play long matches. She's never looked like she's run out of gas to me. But I think there's something in it. That, yeah, she does, I think, probably want it so much that it's hard to just let it go in the tight moments and enable her to play her freest tennis. And I think the flip side of that is exactly what we saw against Pegula in that Miami match that time. She's match point down. Surely she's not going to win. She goes for broke because she's loose, because it's gone. And then suddenly she's playing out of her mind. I know it's not always going to be a hard, fast rule, all that, but I think there's something in it.
Matt, you've got a very big Greek prediction on the line in 2022. I know it's very early days. And to be fair, Zachary, there was no panic in her at all. She was disappointed with this defeat. She said she'd be really down in the dumps for 24 hours, but she said, this does not affect how I feel about my 2022 season. But she doesn't have all of her credibility riding on her 2022 season the way you do, Matt. How are you feeling?
You know, I thought the Australian Open would be a good chance for her, actually. I must say, she likes playing in Melbourne. She gets the support. Given her physical prowess that we've just talked about, I feel like start of the season is a sort of one where she could take advantage of that a little bit. On some other players, it's a blow tonight. It's a blow. Not going to lie, it's a blow.
It shows, by the way, just how another example. Today is a perfect example of the strength of women's tennis. These are cracking players that are losing to other cracking players, and you know, but it makes the business of actually trying to pick out who's going to end up winning harder than ever.
Yeah, who would devise a predictions competition? Only fools. So to round up our review of the women's matches today, Pegula in the quarterfinals will face the toughest task in tennis at the moment. She'll take on the top seed, the world number one, Ash Barty, because Barty beat Amanda Anisimova in a match that Matt and I watched live on the Rod Laver Arena. Matt and I shared a kangaroo dinner. Whilst sitting with Simon Briggs, who was inquiring about how he could see the comments on his Instagram post of his tennis prowess.
He can't, but we can pass them on to him. And we have been.
I've selectively passed on the ones he would like to see.
On the subject of Instagram activity, Catherine's Q&A tonight, which was excellent. The one thing I disagreed with you about, Catherine, is
not marry avoid.
Yeah, I thought I'd opt out of a view on that one. But the one that I do have a view on is who's got the best chance of stopping Ash Barty, which you said, and I understand why you said a big hitter. Well, you know, she's just played a big hitter in Anisimova, and she's carved her up. Okay, Anisimova got the break of serve that we thought she would get in the show last night. But the player I think who's got the best chance of stopping Ash Barty is Simona Halep. You know, she's beaten her three times out of four, and she can go toe-to-toe with her and move with her. And I don't think many of the others can.
Okay, a couple of things. One, don't quote me out of context, David. What I said exactly was, I think it has to be somebody that can overpower her, but it's so difficult for the big hitters to hit their stride against her because of all her slicing and dicing. Mm. So, you know, there's a bit of fence sitting there, I suppose. But look, I would contest that she played the statement that she played a big hitter tonight. Amanda Anisimova did not look like a big hitter tonight. She couldn't really get those strikes in. Barty just, it was a different sport to what we saw Amanda Anisimova and Naomi Osaka playing two nights ago. You know, that description from Osaka of it being like table tennis tennis. It couldn't have been further from that tonight. Amanda Anisimova just couldn't play the match on her terms. What I'm talking about with Barty is somebody, a bit like Keys did to Badosa today, somebody that just comes out and belts it and hopes to just redline it for a whole match and stay there. You know, just takes the racket out of Barty's hand somehow. Anisimova did not do that tonight. She did do the impossible and break the Barty serve, but it was a lone moment, really, in a sea of flailing, really, for Anisimova.
You've got to be able to do something with the Barty slice. Like, I think that is key to being able to play her, and Anisimova couldn't deal with it tonight. I mean, the number of unforced errors she hit, even off that glorious backhand, trying to deal with the Barty slice. I mean, they were numerous. She didn't know. She didn't know whether to sort of, I think, push it back or really swing hard at it. And the errors just mounted up. And Barty used it to outmaneuver her. And she would often hook the forehand cross court and then slice into the open court for a winner. Just, you know, Anisimova really had no answers to Barty's variety. It felt very early on to me that Barty had a clear game plan which was going to work, and Anisimova was going to have to figure it out kind of on the fly. And I thought this would be a more difficult match because of, you know, Anisimova riding this crest of a wave that she's on, and just, I've just thought her sheer confidence might make her figure it out. But actually, Barty quashed that confidence pretty quickly, and I think Anisimova was left with quite a few doubts of just, what do I do against this player? Yeah. No one else I've played plays like this.
I think as well, it makes, because of that variety, when she did get her chances, and she got a few, you know, she had several break points, actually, aside from breaking the serve, and it's in the one time she did. And when I think it probably made her panic a bit, because when she missed two backhand returns long off, you know, right in the slot they were. They were there for her, and she just overhit. And I'm sure that's anxiety of just, I've got to hit the living daylights out of it, you know. And yeah, as you say, Catherine, it's kind of the genius of Barty, isn't it? Nobody else, the uniqueness. Nobody else has got that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, she was just brilliant tonight, wasn't she? And she was interviewed by Jim Courier on the court after the match, and she was asked to kind of compare and contrast this Australian Open with last Australian Open, when I think she played one of her matches during the mini lockdown that happened. And, you know, she just said, obviously, this year is just, you know, a whole lot more fun, I think she said. And Jim Courier was drawing, you know, cheekily drawing some parallels with Barty between this run and some of the opponents that she was playing, and runs she's had at Grand Slams that she's gone on to win, or tournaments that she's gone on to win. And, you know, he said, I think the killer delivery line was, is it a good omen? And she said, well, we'll see, won't we? And, you know, you don't usually get a lot from Ash Barty. She usually shuts stuff like that down. But it was just a little moment of, yeah, I am feeling good.
Yeah, it was. And just going back to this question of who might beat her or what sort of style of play might beat her, I'm trying to think of the losses she took last year. And obviously the Australian Open was Mukova. That would be someone who sort of not quite can match the variety, but, you know, can sort of deal with it, I think. The US Open is interesting because Shelby Rogers is a big hitter and she is someone who can overpower Barty. But my memory from that match is that it was actually when she started moonballing and looping the ball in the final set that she started troubling Barty. And then obviously there's the rivalry Barty had with Sabalenka last year, where Sabalenka did manage to completely overpower Barty in one of their meetings. But generally Barty had the better of that. And I think my sort of conclusion would be, it might not really matter what the style of player is. I think it's going to depend on Barty. I think Barty is going to determine her own fate in this tournament. She can beat anyone, and she probably should beat everyone left. She is the best player in the world, but I don't know whether it's just going to be the occasion or the moment that might get to her more than an opponent, perhaps. And we might just get a flat Barty performance like we have seen. I don't think we will. I think she's handling it all very well, but that to me would sort of be more what I would worry about rather than a specific opponent, perhaps. I think that could happen against anyone, but the Halep head-to-head is interesting.
I hadn't done my homework and research and looked at the Halep head-to-head before. I hadn't looked at all the head-to-heads before I started doing my Instagram Q&A.
This is why we have a podcast, to expand on things.
Yeah, stick to snog, marry, avoid questions in future, Catherine. Don't try and have opinions about tennis.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
How about the men's action that we saw today? Well, there was one medium-sized upset in the men's draw. Denis Shapovalov beat Alexander Zverev 6-3, 7-6, 6-3. This is big for Denis Shapovalov. It's his first victory over a top five player since his breakthrough victory, since he beat Rafael Nadal in 2017, 4.5 years ago now, at the Montreal Canada Masters, of course. And that's a day that Rafael Nadal remembers very well. We'll be hearing from him in exchange I had with him in the press conference in just a moment. But to deal with this match, you've got that record from Shapovalov, and you've got the fact that Zverev is now still yet to beat a top 10 player in a Grand Slam. Obviously, Shapovalov not top 10, but he's lost to him and therefore not put himself in an opportunity to beat a top 10 player. And he's 4-15 against top 20 players at Grand Slams. That's not an accident. That's not a coincidence. There's something going on there in best of five tennis, David.
Yeah, there must be. And yet I thought that was behind us. I really did. And to me, it is a bigger upset than a medium-sized one because of that. I know the end of season isn't necessarily the moment that we should be assuming things. There are so many examples of Tsitsipas and Dimitrov and many other players who've won the end of season, and Zverev himself twice now, winning the end of season finals and then not doing much in Australia. But I thought with the Olympics and with his good performance at the US Open and with the ATP finals and with his just absolute cast iron certainty in his own mind that this is the year he's come in for everybody and he's going to win one of these things, and he may well. But he did look as though he couldn't even in countenance the idea that he wouldn't be one of, frankly, the new big three pretty much this year. And he has been comprehensively outplayed today by a guy who reminded us just how talented he is, just how much dynamite there is in his own ground strokes. Because the way Shapovalov handled Zverev today was like the kid in the playground standing up to the bully and saying, "You are not going to push me around anymore. I've had enough of this." And he was controlled, and he just made Zverev combust, both in terms of his attitude. I mean, it was an absolutely violent racket smash, three parts. But also his game started to fall apart. The forehand started to just shank. The serve started to miss. And I think, and I know Zverev doesn't think he played very well, he said afterwards. He did give some credit to Shapovalov, but he said, I played terribly. But I think he was also made to play terribly by Shapovalov hanging in with him, not going away, and deflecting his power onto him.
Are you saying, David, that this is a new Denis Shapovalov, a mature Denis Shapovalov, a different Denis Shapovalov?
Well,
are you saying the hype train, a close relative of the night train, can start rolling again?
I absolutely think that this could be a starting point. Now, we saw a run to the semis last year at Wimbledon that was truly exciting from Shapovalov, but it felt so isolated. That felt like everything else in his career to date, which is a joy to watch, glorious when it's on, but the chances of it happening regularly or even just frequently are small because of the way he approaches his career. And that's led to me being critical of him. And I'm critical of him with affection because I like him as a lad. I think he's a nice lad. I think he's an absolutely sensational talent. But I think he's under-delivered on his career to this point. Now, he started this year with a new coach. You spoke to him a couple of days ago and you got some really interesting insight from Dennis in our newsletter about why he's chosen to work with Jamie Delgado, who used to coach Andy Murray, and the things that he hopes to bring. Well, before we came on tonight and after that match today, I got in touch with Jamie, who I've known for a long time, and just asked about how he's trying to help Dennis, what the ideas they have are together, and also what he did today in Dennis's corner to try to prepare for Zverev, whether there was anything specific. And he said a lot of the things that I think make an awful lot of sense to us on the Tennis Podcast as seasoned Denis Shapovalov watchers, of not always trying to go from winners no matter where you are in the court. Much as, Catherine, you've always just drooled over the sort of 2 feet off the ground backhand inside out flourished, and we all love it. It makes for tennis TV clips that do a million views and all the rest of it. But how many matches does it win him? Not enough, I would say. And now Jamie wasn't getting into all that, but he was saying he's got to improve his game on the defence, and he's got to get more returns in. And look who he's just beaten back-to-back. Riley Opelka, 7 foot tall, and Alexander Zverev, one of the biggest serves in the sport. And he's got a hell of a lot of returns back in court, you know, and they planned for Zverev. That was clear just in the eye test of watching Denis Shapovalov today. That wasn't just Denis going out there and being Denis. That was prepared for the opponent and, you know, stuck in there, beat him comfortably, really, in straight sets. He could have beaten him even more comfortably. He was just a better player than him, hands down, today. And I think, you know, Denis referenced it in that interview with you the other day, Catherine, that one of the reasons he's gone for Jamie Delgado is because of all the time he spent with Andy Murray. Now, even though a lot of that has been incredibly frustrating years of rehab and not being able to get out on the court, he will have seen Jamie Delgado, what Andy Murray does to get himself ready for tournaments. I mean, Jesus Christ, how has he got himself even back out on the court, Andy Murray, over the last few years? Jamie will have seen all this. And I think it's a great sign that Shapovalov sees that as something he wants to tap into himself. This could be the start of something. Really could.
There it is.
All aboard the night train.
I'm aboard.
Drip, drip.
Bring it on.
We, you know, love the start of something.
I got so many tweets and emails in the last 24 hours, particularly from Canadian tennis watchers saying, why are you so on Felix and Denis Shapovalov case? And I said, did you listen to the end of last night's podcast? And all of them said, oh, no, I haven't got that far yet. Because that was the bit where I actually said, you know, maybe they're starting to do something here. And even,
but
even
I also think perhaps, you know, we really want them to do something, don't we?
Yeah.
We really like them both. We love to watch them. And that's why, you know, we end up talking about them a lot and just willing them on and therefore feeling disappointed when they don't deliver on what we think they're capable of. We really wish them well.
We like them in the interview room. We like them on the court.
It is. It's fair. You know, we can't hold back just because
we're here
like
to
them.
Say what we think. And also what we think is we hope good things for them. But have they under-delivered the last 2 years? Yes, they bloody well have. So good luck to them now, because this feels like something. And I include Felix in that as well. I think he's showing something this year. Not there yet. I think this is more impressive, frankly, from Shapovalov, what he's just done. But maybe Ože Aliassime is the next one.
Shapovalov said on the court he thought he played smart tennis. And my opinion on that was, while watching him, I thought he was still hitting big, but not going for the lines. You know, he was hitting hard to big areas of the court, big targets. And exactly as you say, David, he's still got such pace on his shots that doesn't need to hit the line. As long as he's still hitting a big ball, he is going to knock even someone like Alexander Zverev back, and he is going to be able to take charge of rallies. And I thought he did that really, really well today. And yeah, for Zverev, it's pretty... Is it pretty unprecedented how he manages to make best of three and best of five just look like completely different sports, or like just his results are completely different? He is really good on the tour. I mean, no question about it. He has had some great wins over best of three sets and won big titles. But all these stats about his record at Slams. Okay, I know he reached the US Open final and he's genuinely, you know, made progress at the Slams a little bit, but he's not had to do it by beating really top players. And it's almost like, to me, he's had a bit too much success playing in a way which isn't conducive to beating top players and winning big titles. You know, we've always joked about his, you know, in the past, how he used to go five sets. He used to win those matches. So it wasn't like the style wasn't working. He was still getting through. And then when he comes up against the top players, it's like he sort of thinks, oh, well, I'll do that still, because that's been working. And it doesn't. I mean, he gets exposed, quite frankly, when he plays someone who's at the top of their game, like Shapovalov was today.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not a fitness thing. I think the fitness there, fitness is there. It's not that element of best of five set tennis that's the issue. It's all the other implications thereof. It's a really interesting one.
I do think there's an assumption in him that he's going to win really. And if he plays his tennis, it will be enough. And the thing is, if somebody stands up to it, I don't know whether he's got anywhere to go. And that's what happened today. I mean, the other thing Jamie pointed out to me was stats on his groundstroke speed for Shapovalov, fourth fastest forehand, he reckons, and third fastest backhand. And this, you know, this is publicly available information, but it's just, that is a great thing to know that you've got in your repertoire, is that pace of shot. But it's how you use it. If you're trying to hit blinding winners every single time, as Matt said, it's just not necessary, I'm sure. Because if you look at the best players in the world, Rafael Nadal, Andy Murray, Novak Djokovic, three of the best of all, of certainly of the last 20 years anyway, they're not hitting necessarily the most winners in any given tennis match, and yet they're winning the most matches. So, you know, I mean, Danny Valverde, when he was working with them...
Take a leaf out of the Madison Brengel book. I mean, a win's a win. One winner.
Some of the best tennis...
One winner is sometimes enough.
Some of the tennis that Dimitrov played 3 or 4 years ago when he reached the semis was with Daniel Valverde, who just seemed to simplify his mind into just forehand, movement, serve. You know, focus on those things and find repeatable ways to win points. And anyway, it was a very exciting performance from Shapovalov and a very, very professional one too.
Mm. And he'll need the same, won't he, in the quarterfinal where he'll be facing Rafael Nadal. Nadal beat Adrian Mannarino today in 3 sets. That sentence by no means tells the story of this match. There was a 28-minute first set tiebreak, won by Nadal, 16-14. It was, and I know we've used this word a lot, but it was epic.
It was the longest tiebreak of Nadal's career. In terms of points, anyway, I should think in terms of time. And it was epic. I mean, it was really high quality. They were both coming up with brilliant shots. There was a Nadal forehand pass, which we both sort of jumped out of our chairs at. There was a Mannarino forehand onto the line to save set point, which I think we all thought had gone out, and turned out it had brushed the line. It was stunning, actually, and Mannarino was flagging, I think, a bit physically during it. But it was
Well, he didn't know he was going to be playing Nadal. So he didn't know how tough it was going to be.
And then, you know, Nadal just wouldn't give in, would he? He saved multiple set points. He wasn't fazed by the fact that his were coming and going. It was an unbelievable tiebreak. And I think the first set lasted longer than the second and third set put together. That was the match, really, right there and then. And as soon as Nadal won it, he was away, wasn't he?
He was so happy after that win. He has been so happy all tournament. You know, we've covered this after his last couple of victories. He didn't expect to be anywhere near here. Just, I mean, quarterfinals of the Australian Open. I mean, at the start of the tournament, before he'd even taken the court, he said, you know, if you'd offered me just being in the draw at the Australian Open a few months ago, he said, I would have signed the paper. That was his sort of expression that he was, he said it on the court as well. He said, I would have signed for that. And here he is in the quarterfinals playing brilliantly, really, really brilliantly. He's, you know, it's just, it's the same as we've said after many of his other wins this tournament so far, sight for sore eyes. It really is. And I cannot wait to see him take on Denis Shapovalov in a couple of days' time. Nadal's beaten him every time they've played since that breakthrough victory that Shapovalov had in 2017. And as I said, that was something that I asked Rafael Nadal about after his win today.
Just wanted to ask you about your next opponent, Denis Shapovalov, and actually your first meeting with him back in 2017. I know you've played since then, but that day he beat you in Canada, what are your memories of that match, and what have you made of his progress since then?
It was a tough one, that one, I remember, because I was playing for the number one. But he played great. Honestly, he was very young, and he played with... amazing intensity and creating amazing shots. And as everybody knows, he's one of the players with the biggest potential on the tour. I mean, when I played against him after the match, I said he's going to be a potential multi Grand Slam winner. And I still think that if he is able to keep improving, he will be a multi Grand Slam winner. No, he has a lot of amazing things on his game, and his results says that when he's playing well, it's very difficult to stop him. No, so you can see today against a great player like Sasha, straight sets. If he's able to play regular in terms of his level, going to be a potential very, very high-ranking player. So, going to be a tough one for me, but I'm in quarterfinals. What what to expect, no? I mean, it's a match to try my best, to play at my highest level if I want to have chances to go through, and I'm excited about it, honestly. No, I didn't expect to be where I am weeks ago.
I mean, he really is excited. He genuinely is. Every time he says, I'm in the quarterfinals, he just has this enormous grin on his face. It's wonderful to see. But I found that quite interesting, or very interesting, in fact, what he said about Denis Shapovalov. And I know there's a big, you know, Nadal if in there, you know, if he keeps improving, that is a big if. But I still think that's a big prediction. You know, I toss big rogue predictions out left, right and centre, and I'm not saying he's going to be a multi-Grand Slam champion. He might be, but I certainly wouldn't, you know, stick my neck on the line the way he has. I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the things Nadal will really appreciate in Shapovalov as a tennis player, because I think he will appreciate how hardworking he is, how seriously he takes his career, you know, hiring someone like Jamie Delgado, looking for that little edge. I think he will know from their meeting in Rome last year, actually on the clay. I think that might have gone to a deciding set tiebreak. It was very, very close. He knows Shapovalov can hurt him. But it's interesting because that Montreal win in 2017, it's kind of defining for Shapovalov. You know, it was sort of carefree, playing without abandon, you know, playing with abandon tennis, you know. And it's the sort of tennis you can do when you're coming onto the tour. And it's the sort of tennis he's tried to keep doing the whole time, like we've been talking about. And actually what he probably needs to do, just as we've said, is slightly move away from that and become more disciplined. And if he is doing that, then that probably makes him a more dangerous prospect, really. And I think Nadal will know that. I mean he got caught that night by Shapovalov, and everything was going in, and it was incredible, and the atmosphere was electric. But I think he will think Shapovalov's more dangerous if he's actually disciplined and playing smart tennis, as we've described.
Yeah, Nadal isn't seduced by a feet off the ground, single-handed, inside-out backhand the way some of us are. So Nadal against Shapovalov in a couple of days' time. The other quarterfinal from that half will be Matteo Berrettini against Gael Monfils. We've just watched Matteo Berrettini win through in three tight sets against Pablo Carreño Busta. Kind of, I think, what we all expected, Berrettini to be too strong in the end. I think he was, well, certainly at the time we started recording, so early doors in the third set, he was serving 80% first serves in, they said on Channel 9, which is fearsome stuff. Carreño Busta gives you nothing for free, so kept it tight, but Berrettini too strong. But, David, you've already said in this podcast that Gael Monfils, aged 35, is playing the tennis of his life. Tell us
yes.
why.
Well, I mean, I may be getting seduced as well by the whole the whole moment, the whole feel. He makes me feel so great watching him at the moment, and because he's clearly enjoying it so much. I was a bit worried for him in the third set against Miomir Kecmanovic because he was sort of hunched over on his knees, looking as though he was not far out of gas, to be honest, Monfils. But the ball striking we were witnessing, he decided to go out there and meet fire with fire because Kecmanovic hits a big ball. And the second set tiebreak they played, I mean, all three sets were really close, 7-5, 7-6. This is the kind of match it was. But the second set tiebreak, I don't think there was a point ended that wasn't a winner from either side of the net. It was just gasp-inducing from both players because Kecmanovic just goes for it. And Monfils clearly just decided to stand toe-to-toe. And I've seen it a few times in his career when he's done that. He reached the Monte Carlo final a few years ago and beat Federer and Dimitrov back-to-back, just blasted them off the court. And I've often thought, why don't we get that more from Gael Monfils? Why does he get involved in these rallies that are incredible to watch but which are not really that efficient and not really getting him that much benefit? And here he is now. It's just, again, he just seems to be playing with abandon and enjoyment and joy. And I loved it. And I feel like he's really dangerous. And he referenced his record, his match against Berrettini, losing 7-6 in the fifth against him at the US Open a couple of years ago. He said that in his post-match on-court interview. And that could be a crack. If he's fully fit, that's a big question. But if Monfils is fully fit, he might do it.
Well, he said in his post-match on-court interview, "I'm not finished yet." And asked about his next opponent, he said, "Whoever it is, I'm going to be ready for them." It's business bun, Monfils, is what yes. It is. And we all absolutely love it, I think. And yeah, Monfils Berrettini is what I wanted to see from that quarter, and I'm delighted that that is going to play out. One other line to bring you from today, as reported by WTA Insider and Reem Abalil, the journalist from the National, drew my attention to this on Twitter today. A couple of massive milestone in the junior competition today, and please excuse my attempt at pronunciation here. These aren't names we're familiar with yet, although we very well might be one day. But we have Mesh Katalzara Safi becoming the first girl from Iran to win a Grand Slam juniors match, and in about 35 degrees. She was out there in a headscarf and, you know, long sleeve top and leggings as well. And, you know, there was a time when women weren't allowed to play tennis in leggings, not that long ago. So extraordinary to see that, an incredible story. And we had Angela Okutoyi becoming the first girl from Kenya to win a Grand Slam juniors match. And I know it's something that the ITF are very invested in, you know, diversifying the presence of tennis around the world and making it more possible for people from non-traditional tennis countries and areas to be able to play the sport. And obviously there's a heck of a long way to go in that regard, but these things matter, you know, their progress. And we'll be following their progress through the tournament as well. I think that's it for your Day 7 podcast. We're now officially time-wise at the halfway stage of the tournament with the business end. Things get very real now and we can't wait. We are loving being here. We're loving covering this tournament. We're loving chatting to David every night and getting his, you know,
Hot takes
and, you know, chats with coaches. We're loving it. It's absolutely brilliant. So thanks to friends of the pod for making it possible. We've still got 7 more of these things to come, and there'll be a review show for Friends of the Pod as well coming in the days after this podcast. We've got Charlie, our lovely beagle mascot, We love Charlie and we love Charlie content. Keep it coming, Phil and Gina, his owners in Chicago. Billie Jean is with Rosie this weekend, and there might be some Billie Jean and Rosie content coming your way on Instagram if you head over there. She's sponsored by Billie Jean King and Ilana Kloss. David's got Darwin.
Right, Darwin.
You got points today, David. No, you didn't get points today. No, we'll move on. I didn't get points either. We were left with the crumbs off the table, David, predictions-wise. Matt and Gerald did score points, but we won't dwell there. Chris Albert Lee and Kyle Weingartner are our executive producers and top blokes. And I'd just like to say just a very quick general shout-out to everybody that has come and said hello and said nice things about the podcast to Matt and me while we've been out and about at Melbourne Park, and also asked after David. And said they miss your very long arm, David, for selfie-taking purposes. We've had that a few times. So thank you very much. It really means a lot to us. Sorry if we're sort of ever a bit weird and awkward. It overwhelms us a little bit. We'll never get used, I don't think, to people coming and wanting photos with us. But it's very touching, and thank you very much. Matt, we have shout-outs.
Also, I am just a bit weird and awkward. We have Rachel Jones today, originally from Wolverhampton.
Hey!
She now lives in Vollero, which is near Zurich in Switzerland.
Oh. I'd call that an upgrade, would you, David?
Well, yeah, I mean, Wolverhampton, up the road from where I live. And my team's biggest rivals, Wolves, well, one of them anyway, one of them and Villa. But anyway, I like Rachel Jones from Wolverhampton, I've decided. So thanks very much for being our friend.
I do too. Thank you very much, Rachel, and hello.
We also have Brendan McHale from Dublin.
Like Christina McHale.
Indeed.
Yes. Oh, Brendan.
Sorry, where was Brendan from?
From Dublin.
Oh.
Oh.
Hello, Brendan, in Dublin.
Quite a lot of listeners Dublin. In Dublin, and I don't know why. I find that really lovely. I love the idea of lots of people in Ireland listening.
Everyone
to us.
Finds sort of Irish things lovely, don't they?
Yeah.
It's hard to feel anything negative about Ireland. Hello, Brendan. Thank you very much.
And third today is Elise Lane from Newcastle upon Tyne.
Like Elise Cornet?
No, like Elise Mertens.
Oh, right.
Mm. Right, Elise. Bet she's got a good backhand.
Is that Elise Merton's best shot?
I think so.
Yeah? Okay.
Solid as a rock.
That.
She's still in the tournament, isn't she?
On court tomorrow.
She is still in the tournament, David. She plays Danielle.
I have not thought
tomorrow.
About Elise Mertens all tournament until now.
Nobody has. Danielle Collins, Elise Mertens opens up the Rod Laver Arena. Then it's Halep against Cornet.
As well.
She could do the double, David. Then it's Alex de Minaur against Yannick Sinner. Night session is Fritz Tsitsipas, followed by Kanepi Sabalenka. Love that, but those two matches should be the other way around. And not before 2 p.m. is when the single starts on the second court. And that, David, is when you're not allowed to set your alarm for. But it is when Maxime Cressy against Daniil Medvedev starts. And that's followed by Iga Świątek and Sarana Cristea. So David is going to get in a time machine, go back to the 90s and set his video for Maxime Cressy against Daniil Medvedev. And we'll be back with the tennis podcast. We'll be back with the tennis podcast tomorrow to review it all for you, just in case you don't have a video. We'll speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.